Welcome to Trending in Education. Mike Palmer here. I'm joined today by Laura Papano, who is the author of a new book called School Moms, Parent Activism, Partisan Politics, and the Battle for Public Education. For those of you who are watching, there it is. It's a really interesting read. Laura's got an amazing background in education, primarily as an education journalist, but there's plenty of other ways in which she's intersected with education throughout her life. Laura, welcome to Trending in Education.
Thrilled to be here.
Your book is excellent, and it's very timely. As I like to say, it's zeitgeisty, and it's something that I think folks who listen to the show will want to learn more about. Before we get into the book and a lot of the topics that are outlined there, I always like to start by getting to know our guests a little bit better. Can you catch us up on your background, how you got to this point in your professional life?
Sure. I mean, I am a product of public schools, and my parents were really young when they had me. They were 17, and we moved a lot. So I had been in multiple school systems by the time I was in sixth grade. But I graduated from public schools, and when I was in high school, I served on the local school board as a student rep, and I would go there after sports practice, after a job, and late. And it would, you know, and I would fall asleep. And it was a source of huge embarrassment at the time. I still remember Ellen Moore would wear these short, you know, mint colored, you know, short sleeve tops with her arms folded over. And she would talk in this soothing voice. Yeah. And didn't take a lot. And I was gone. But the point of that, of bringing that up, is that they did boring stuff. But they did important boring stuff, and that someone like me who had a disheveled home life felt that, you know, that things were going to be okay because I could count on school. I could count on the rhythm of the year, of the day. I could count on friends and teachers and people just, you know, showing me a way to be. It's at school that I, you know, figured out who I was and grew up. And I worry that we are losing some of that now.
And then from there, that led you into a lengthy career in education journalism. Can you talk about that? Because you've actually, you know, worn a few different hats in the space.
Yes, I've covered education, K-12 and higher ed for 30 plus years. Really the plus, emphasis, lean on the plus a little bit because I'm just trying to seem a little younger. But, and the reason is that I always felt that education told the story of our country and told the story of people's lives. So I was always drawn to that. Mm-hmm. And at the time, I was a young reporter in Massachusetts, and there was a lot of, you know, figuring out reform going on. When I was in school, teachers taught whatever the heck they wanted to teach. Mm-hmm. And it was really more about the process of education, you know, and if education was happening in a classroom, we were all good.
Right.
And then suddenly there was concern that, well, shouldn't people be learning certain things? And how do we know if they're learning those things? Mm-hmm. When I first started as an education journalist, they would do test scores, you know, every few years, but they would only compare the results for socioeconomically similar communities. Mm-hmm. So there you have a set of expectations that says, well, if you're from a low-income community, you're only expected to do as well as other low-income communities. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was that question of, shouldn't we make sure that everyone can do well, that a lot of the reform efforts grew out of. And, you know, that's a whole nother podcast, but there's a lot of really interesting stuff there. But I found in it some really compelling stories. So I did that. And then, you know, when I had children myself, I have three kids and I was a PTO mom. And then, you know, when we were in Massachusetts, I started a school newspaper, my kids' elementary school, which was a lot of fun. And some of those kids now are journalists and writers.
Right.
And which is wonderful. And then I went, when I moved to New Haven, Connecticut, started the New Haven Student Journalism Project and have done youth journalism since then, you know, and I mentor kids and have helped them apply to college and some are in and graduated from college. So it's a service, but it's also informing my own reporting and understanding. For example, I knew about TikTok way before any adults had ever heard about it.
Yeah, exactly. And we'll include links to that project and that program because that is worth a deeper dive, I think, just in terms of what it might mean for the future of education, future of work, some of the topics that come up on the show, just a different model that is connecting young kids with older college age peers, learning about journalism and really getting some mentorship from folks like yourself. Really interesting program, but we don't want to distract ourselves from the book School Moms, which is an interesting title. And then it also, you know, what I loved about it is the stories you're able to tell, including stories where you are the protagonist in a lot of ways. You are in a first person role that is interesting for us to identify with as you get closer to Moms for Liberty and some of the new political movements that have emerged in the last few years that are really, you know, polarizing and politicizing school boards and making K-12 education a much more challenging space for a lot of us. Can you catch us up on what really drove you to write School Moms?
Sure, Mike, that's a great question. I mean, having covered education for so many years, I was seeing and hearing so much that was going on in schools that was not about education. And not only that, it was an attack on education. And so I signed up for the first Moms for Liberty Summit in Tampa, Florida in July 2022. I did order myself 2 t-shirts and I had a red blazer, bought a, you know, American flag pin. And I went down there and it was a, you know, hot, humid July in Tampa. And the curious thing was that right at the, you know, I check into the hotel and the clerk whispers, she says, "Oh, you guys, everyone." And I was like, "What?" And then suddenly I'm on a high floor with a water view. But the really curious thing about being there was that right kitty corner to the hotel was the Tampa Convention Center, which was having what was being billed as Florida's largest anime convention. So then you have this surreal experience of you're on the one hand, the Moms for Liberty. And on the other hand, there are people in the lobby on the streets with glitter and horns and colonial garb and wings and the rest of it. And it was just, it was, I mean, I would just will never forget it. It was a really striking experience. And it maybe was a good kind of stage set for the actual summit. As a journalist, I'm very accustomed to being in situations where there's a lot of different views on things. Mm-hmm. And my main job is really to go in and listen and to really think about what I'm hearing, to try to, you know, without judging, really put together their line of thinking, you know, and logic. And so I was expecting to go into the Moms for Liberty Summit and be confused. And what I found when I was in the ballroom within the first, you know, 30 minutes, it was anything but confusing. You know, when you are hearing from the stage that sending your child to public schools for 30 to 35 hours a week is like sending them to a Maoist reform prison camp, I was just stunned. And what was even more stunning to me was that that kind of extreme rhetoric continued throughout the days. And I found that summit was really about pitching to the 500 moms or so in the room that their children were in danger. They were being harmed. And they had to push aside their feminine role of taking a back seat. I mean, there was even a discussion of laundry at one point, but that they had to step out because their children were in danger. And what do moms do when their children are being threatened? They push aside their own fears and they put themselves out.
Right.
And that's what the pitch was.
This is 2022. Where was that in the progression? Moms for Liberty is a relatively recent movement, right?
They actually filed, you know, I believe in January 2021, but the first summit was in July of 2022.
Got it.
And their second summit was in July of 2023 in Philly.
Right. And that was what was interesting to me was, you know, both the fact that you were on this from as early a stage as you were, where that was the first time they really were getting together as a group less than 2 years ago, you were there. And then within even that 1 year from the first summit to the second one, there was some significant transformation to what was going on and the level of public awareness, the level of protest against what was going on. Can you lay out a little bit the transition from 1 year to the next?
That's a really great point, because when I was there at that first summit, there were a few protesters on an island across from the hotel. And they were so few that, you know, some of the local Moms for Liberty chapters were ridiculing them on Twitter.
Right.
And then the following year, when I was in Philly, and I wrote a piece for Slate, and I kind of compared the two in that piece, Slate and Hechinger Report. Mm-hmm. And we were told, don't go on the street with your credentials. And so I was I was at the Moms for Liberty. I always register under my name. I'm not trying to trick anybody.
Yeah.
Register under my name, you know, try to dress to fit in.
Yeah.
But then when I was going out to cover the protests, I found that, like, I could not walk out there in a red blazer and my outfit. So I would go up to my room, switch into my black t-shirt and jeans, go out, do those interviews, come back inside, go up to my room, switch back into the blazer.
Yeah.
And it was striking to me how vibrant the protests were. I mean, they were everywhere. You could hear them, mm-hmm. See them. It was, even for the opening reception for the Moms for Liberty, you know, at the first event, it was, you know, at the same hotel, you walked out onto a rooftop, there was a band playing. I happened upon the Brevard County Moms for Liberty folks, who were very proud that they were the first chapter of Brevard County board up. And I casually asked, I said, well, what got you guys involved in this? And several of them, and I remember one in particular said, I didn't want my daughter's junior year of high school to be ruined with masks.
Right.
And I was stunned at how little it took for people to decide that they were going to throw their entire identity and weight into this project.
Right.
When we in Philly, you know, the opening reception was not that far from the hotel. I'm a big walker. I would have just, you know, college athlete, I would have just walked there. But we were told, no, everyone must ride on the buses. Mm. And we get off the bus and there are police everywhere. There are barricades. There are people yelling.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was quite striking. And I guess one of the things for me as I sat in that first welcome breakfast at the Moms for Liberty in Philly this past July, is I was like, why did they have it here?
Yeah.
I mean, Philly is one of the most diverse cities in America,
mm-hmm.
most welcoming. And not only that, they've chosen a hotel in the gayborhood. And I'm listening to the, you know, the welcome, and Tina Deskovich starts evoking the patriots who walked these streets. I'm thinking, that is all well and good, but there's a blindness to the present that I find alarming. But it told me a lot at the same time.
Yeah. And the stories in the book, I think, really are evocative. They definitely get you aware of the issue. But then I was struck by how much this is preying on emotion in a lot of ways. It's both preying on emotion and then attacking social emotional learning, which is another element to this that I find striking, because for years I like to loosely quote Whitney Houston and say, I get social emotional, baby, because I enjoy doing that. And it's always been a trend that I track as something that's on the rise. But then to see it very much in the crosshairs of this political movement. And then the other element that came out in the book that I think we should touch on is that this is not a pure grassroots effort that we're talking about when we talk about Moms for Liberty. This is funded and supported by a lot of PACs and, you know, a lot of the moneyed conservative movement that is out there. Can you portray a little bit more of what's happening? The title School Moms is interesting because in a lot of ways you're speaking to school moms who are not represented by Moms for Liberty.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, the book is actually about their pushback. I mean, that's a really important piece of it. To your question, this has a long history, right? And the kind of culmination, moms are being used on the far right. And
right. There's a Steve Bannon quote, right?
Yes. So just to back up a bit, at that first summit, I noticed that every single time, you know, part of the language of you need to protect your children is you need to run for school board. Mm-hmm. And every time that they, you know, mentioned school board, you know, people were asked to rise, that they were running, applause.
Yeah.
And from the stage, Ron DeSantis, who at that time was perceived as, you know, having a bright presidential.
It was a rising star who may have set since then. Yes.
And what he did is he said, for the first time, I am going to endorse 30 school board candidates. Now, if you just stop and think about it, a governor.
Yeah.
endorsing a school board candidate is like, what is going on here?
Right.
Well, the moms who were endorsed were just absolutely flattered. But what I immediately realized was no. The opposite thing is going on. He is tapping into what has long been
right,
very organized, networked,
yeah,
motivated
mm-hmm.
constituency, which are school moms, which are
yeah. moms. Soccer moms, suburban, middle-class voters. You always hear those terms out there. This is who they're speaking to.
Yes. And not only that, they're activating them for their own purposes. And what you realize is that, you know, that activity, in some ways, it's rather devious, but it has a very long history. Mm. And what they've been trying to do this for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And as I was walking outside at the first summit, there was the Noah Webster Society, which I always thought of as kind of a sleepy conservative education group.
Yeah.
And the guy behind the table was just thrilled because they had just started an online school board training and had like 600 signups.
Mm-hmm.
And there was just a lot of, that was very exciting. And then the next month, the Leadership Institute, which started in 1979, started online school board training. So these groups had paid no attention to women, moms,
mm-hmm.
who were realizing, oh my gosh, what a powerful constituency we have. And just around that time, that spring of 2022, after Patriot Mobile Action had poured $400,000 into 11 school board races in North Texas, flipped four districts, Steve Bannon was beside himself with joy.
Yeah.
That the school boards are the key that picks the lock.
Mm-hmm.
His point was that school boards, and he said this, this is how we're going to take back America. One district by district, town by town.
Yeah.
Well, it's a real recognition by the far right that, oh my gosh, this is valuable real estate that we have not claimed enough.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I do think that the moderates and others have not either, right? I mean, school board races have very low turnout. No one's paying attention. And because people were not paying attention, it has been easier than it should be
mm-hmm.
for extremists to gain control of school boards and then to wreak havoc on children in schools and classrooms.
Yeah.
So it really is, you know, we're really in a moment where we have to pay attention to things that we didn't think we had to pay attention to.
Yeah, exactly. And as a journalist, you know, I'm sure there's the desire to be impartial and not to come out as partisan. But when reporting on these types of phenomena and the threat that they are presenting, it's important, I think, to speak up. And that's why the book, I think, is an important one for folks to be aware of. And then the other element, the other call to action, I imagine here is to understand, you know, A, how do I vote in these school boards? Like, make sure that I actually show up for those elections. But, you know, at the same time, when should I actually throw my hat in the ring and think about running and actually activating? Can you talk about that?
Well, I want to be clear about one thing, is that I don't view this work as partisan work.
Mm-hmm.
I really do. I mean, there's nothing wrong with conservative values, nothing wrong with Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
And there are many Republicans who are in the book.
Yep.
And this is really about extremism.
Mm-hmm.
And extremism is a threat to the very public schools that I've covered for over three decades.
Right.
Do I still see problems in public schools? Do I still have critiques? Absolutely. There are things that are sloppy, that don't work, things that are great ideas that we should give a try. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
So my frustration was that we are not able to have that conversation because we're being distracted by an actually concerted effort to destroy public schools and to take these spaces, which have been historically nonpartisan spaces.
Yes.
And make them into a far right, you know, to a political power platform for the far right. And that is not partisan. It's calling out the problem. And I do believe that that's one of the confusions that many education journalists initially, and I think it's changing, initially had.
Yeah.
I mean, when I was first doing the reporting for this, there was this kind of effort to balance both sides, you know, this
right.
Osage journalism. And it was the same problem that, you know, journalists encountered when Trump was president. Do we really report on everything he's saying? And do we, you know, just report it as fact? Because historically, you know, authority figures in those positions, you took what they said. So I don't view it as a partisan thing. I view it as a necessary speaking out so that we can get back to arguing about what's the best way to teach math. I mean, I've done decades of work on reading and math and, you know, on all of those subjects. So that's not the conversation that we've been having.
Yeah, there's a real opportunity cost to having to engage with this. It does remind me of the old adage out there that it's an order of magnitude greater to contain bullshit than to generate it in the first place. And it is really hard to kind of counter this, especially when it is systematic and well-funded and well-organized. My wife would want me to talk about librarians, you know, and the fact that our school librarians are now on the front lines of our culture wars was something I was dimly aware of, but I found it shocking to see in your book the level to which there's a systemic attack on them. Can you lay that out for us?
So to your very point, I mean, when you say things enough times and loudly enough, then it passes, right? I just want to set the record straight. Libraries are not collecting pornography.
Mm-hmm.
Teachers are not trying to change the gender of your child.
Mm-hmm.
Social emotional learning is not, you know, Marxist indoctrination.
Yeah, it actually helps with academic performance. It helps with whatever metrics you wanted.
Research
when done well, it works well. Yes.
Right, exactly. And yet what's happened is that there's become a crusade around this because it catches people off guard and it's been effective.
Mm-hmm.
And what you have is you have, you know, these well-funded far-right groups at the top who are leading this crusade against the things that are catching on.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, only 8% of funding is federal for in your typical school budget. And so it's really a local and state issue.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, local school boards have become a very contested space and state legislatures. And if you've noticed, we are seeing parental rights laws. This year in legislative sessions, we're going to see a lot of voucher legislation. And parental rights are, you know, fabulous, but we already have parental rights.
Mm-hmm.
We don't need laws that are called parental rights that merely are kind of gag laws that restrict what books can be in libraries,
right,
what teachers can say or hang on their walls. So what's happening, though, is these well-funded far-right organizations draft model legislation and state legislators just pick it up. And I've been told that sometimes they don't even remember to change the name of the state when they are doing it.
Right.
But what you have is you have these groups. I mean, the Leadership Institute, for example, since late 1970s, Morton Blackwell, they train conservative leaders. And what you have is you have them. I looked at their 990s. Their donations more than double between 2017 and 2021.
Right.
They have a lot of money to, as I discovered when I was at the first Moms for Liberty Summit, they will go anywhere for free and train your school board.
Right.
Respective school board members.
Mm-hmm.
So you have those sorts of resources and you have all of these groups that for years have been looking for a way to get their ideas out there, and suddenly
mm-hmm.
it has fallen on their laps.
Right.
The Moms for Liberty framed some things that others have grabbed onto, and now you're seeing it just exploded.
Yeah. Although it was interesting to me how short the history of Moms for Liberty specifically is, and it does almost feel like they at least went through their first crest, and now there's certainly some pushback. And, you know, it is 2024. We try not to be overly political, but it is a political year.
Yes.
And, you know, the question is, I think, timing wise, who is reaching the hearts and minds of those moms and dads who are thinking about their kids? Education is maybe a big issue for them. And how much was what, you know, really grew out of anti-mask activation in Florida? How much of that will really carry meaningful political sway in 2024. I guess the jury's out, but part of what I'm reading in the book is that we need to be talking about this so that we're going in with our eyes open. And then also, ideally, engaging more folks in what the conversation really should be about. You know, I know you've been out in the field too. The other reason why, you know, it's great having you on there is like you're kind of like a, you've been a field reporter to some extent over the last few years. What are you sensing out there? What are you picking up on in terms of, you know, the spirit of folks and how the conversation around education and parents and maybe the political side of it, how would you characterize that?
What you're describing is this need for people to wake up. But what we're seeing and what I'm seeing on the ground is the Moms for Liberty, you're right, is a fairly new organization. But we've got Parents Defending Education. There is a whole group of them. They're just the ones who happen to get, you know, the headlines.
Yeah.
But there are recently Connecticut, Massachusetts, Parents Defending Education end up showing up at local school board meetings.
Yeah.
So this is happening. And what I think Moms for Liberty did was give people a frame and a language. Mm-hmm. And in a way that people had not put together before. So I think they were very effective on that front. Mm-hmm. They did suffer a lot of losses in the November elections in places like Bucks County. Right.
So,
but I was just in Bucks County last week in Central Bucks. And I will tell you that nobody there is sitting down. Everyone is recognizing that at any moment this flips back because these are highly, highly contested spaces. What's interesting to me and why I think we need to be paying special attention is that we are seeing, even though these are all local races, we are seeing the nationalization of political rhetoric.
Yes.
I felt that I did a story for the Hechinger Report and Vanity Fair that was out in December, where I spent 6 months in North Idaho. Mm-hmm. And in that district, there was a rural district that was taken over by far-right candidates and far-right school board members. And, you know, for 2 years running, they have now not had an English language arts curriculum. Mm-hmm. Because it contained Sesame Street characters and social-emotional learning.
Right.
Books were literally in the school, shipped back. And this is a district where their previous English language arts curriculum was out of print. So I was talking to a fourth grade teacher who had only 10 workbooks for her entire class. So they don't have the materials. But at the same time, when I was on the ground there on election day, standing on a dirt road, you know, in near one of the voting places, you know, listening to the campaign, the far right campaign folks talking to prospective voters, they were arguing. They said, you know, so-and-so will keep boys out of girls' bathrooms. Mm-hmm. One of the key issues in the race was, quote unquote, transgenderism. Well, I can tell you that that is not the big issue in the race. Hmm. Big issue in the district was the fact that, you know, they had no English language arts curriculum. They had failed to pass a levy. They were not cleaning the school buildings. There were mice in one school board meeting. The principal stood up and said, there are mice running over children's feet.
Yeah.
You have the national language used for a local purpose when they're ignoring what is the real local community educational need.
Yeah.
And that is a real problem.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's laid out, you know, I'm thinking of there's the nonpartisan school board candidate who winds up losing her seat. There's the school librarian who has to tell her kids that we can't get new books because it needs to be approved by a school board. It's kind of shocking, which is why I do appreciate you putting it to paper. And there is a book out there. It's called School Moms, Parent Activism, Partisan Politics, and the Battle for Public Education. Laura Papano is my guest today. Check out the book. Check out what Laura's doing. It's all really interesting. I'd love to get maybe a little more of your perspective, stepping back a little bit as someone who's been so deeply immersed in education over the years. Where do you see stuff heading? I mean, there's going to be a pretty critical election cycle this year, clearly. But looking a little bit further out, what do you see on the horizon? What are some of the topics and themes that are really capturing your attention these days?
Oh, my goodness. Where to start, right? But and I'm sorry we didn't dig even more into the book stuff. It is fascinating.
Yeah.
Looking back at the history of book banning.
Right. Well, that's the other thing you mentioned, you know, the Red Scare, and I've heard this now called the Ed Scare. You went into McCarthyism in some depth, and I've heard, I think some folks at Pen America were talking about this as almost like an Ed Scare, where like very systematically, you know, similar to what McCarthy was doing around like Americanism, there is this activation that is very much founded on misinformation and disorientation is part of the strategy. Yeah, we could stay on it.
The book stuff, if you go, you know, and it's in School Moms, that digs back into back in Kanawha County and mm-hmm. in the 1982 Pico versus Island Street School District, you're seeing the same things come up again. Mm-hmm. But in the bigger landscape is this exactly what you said, this effort at controlling and trying to really prescribe, taking away the professionalism from the professionals.
Right.
Librarians are exquisitely trained mm-hmm. to curate. You know, in the course of reporting this book with several librarians, I said, walk me through your training, walk me through the job. You know, we just think, you know, my husband thinks they just sit at the desk and check things out and stamp the books.
Right? Yeah.
It's a very complicated profession that has a lot of skill and judgment involved. And so what we're seeing is we're seeing them being completely that authority taken away. And I think you alluded to it. And I think you were alluding to Keller, Texas. And in Keller, Texas, one of those school districts that got flipped to the far right, mm-hmm. they completely changed how books get into the library.
Right.
And what they did is they decided that the school board had to then approve all of the books. Mm-hmm. rather than librarians. Mm-hmm. So suddenly I was watching a 5.5-hour school board meeting and a librarian stands up and she says, I cannot in a timely manner get books on camels or football or squirrels. I cannot get the latest Diary of a Wimpy Kid or the latest book of Guinness Book of World Records.
Right.
Because of the new policy.
Right. Dictionaries, I think, were mentioned as well because there were new words being added, I guess.
So this fear, this kind of, we're in this reign of fear and these laws that are being passed around divisive concepts and efforts to control children in schools in ways that, you know, that with either parental oversight or, you know, legal oversight are just really, really troubling. Librarians are trained for this. And I also, and we were talking about this before, is that I believe that school is a place, like it was for me growing up,
yeah.
to try things out. As I've, you know, you can be goth one week and prep the next. You can try out a nickname. You
yeah.
can, we need the freedom. And it's a safe space in which to try these things and to figure out who you are and to, you know, develop friendships across.
Yeah. And even as a parent of a 5-year-old, like I know I'm too attached to him. You know, I actually do know, like having, you know, lived through the pandemic with him and he's a great kid, but like there needs to be another space for him to form his identity and for him to engage with adults who care about him, who he trusts, who know his name. Like there is a positive framing for that. And also I think for the relationship between parents and teachers, where I feel like this adversarial positioning mm-hmm. is not the way you want to go at it as a parent.
Yeah, it's not productive. And it's not as if schools don't make mistakes. I remember when my daughter, who is a principal in Dallas now, went to Yale, great, you know, really rigorous leader and student, yet she's dyslexic.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't know it. And yet when she was in second grade, I remember her having me test her on spelling words. And I was like, wait, these are spelled incorrectly. Mm-hmm. And I went to the teacher, I said, you're giving the kids to do spelling with the word spelled incorrectly.
Mm.
Now, I was not happy about that, but that doesn't mean that I need to trash all of public school.
Right. That's a call for you to become engaged, and you were, and you did, you know, and that's where
I did,
like,
and I used that teacher's classroom to start a school newspaper after school.
Exactly.
But I mean, people make, you know, this is, it's not a perfect system,
yeah.
but it's a good system, and it's the bones of public education. Or they bring us together to try to do the best job that we can.
Mm-hmm.
There will be mistakes. There will be things that don't go right.
Right.
But we should be leaning on correction and not trying to obliterate
right.
the structure that brings us and allows us to be connected
right.
around things that are not political, but
right.
that are around all of us, you know, working for our kids. I was, baking scones for the teacher appreciation breakfast or starting a school newspaper in the school,
yeah,
or running a science fair. There's a lot that is good about the structure of public schools. And right now, the far right would have you think that it's so, you know, in trouble and problematic that,
yeah,
we need to play with it.
Yeah. And it reminds me, it's the old saw, you know, take your ball and go home. It's like, take some of the funding. Homeschooling is another angle to this as well. And, you know, charter schools, following the money is something that's pretty nicely outlaid in the book, in addition to the stories of the people who are doing the good work. It's really a fascinating read. I would recommend it. The name of the book, again, is School Moms, Parent Activism, Partisan Politics, and the Battle for Public Education.
Charter school, we get into a whole charter school thing where the idea of charter schools,
yeah,
is a good idea.
Yes.
But we're seeing that name, mm-hmm, like all the other things, being used, mm-hmm, for charter voucher schools, which,
yes,
we have very little oversight and no, and very little interest in actually teaching kids anything. They,
right,
just want the money. So,
yeah,
there's a lot of distortion and a lot of usurping of what the good parts of public education are and should be.
Yeah. And it's a place where good curation and knowing where to go to kind of get good information. There's just a lot of fatigue nowadays. Folks are just tired. And not to mention, we didn't even get into how hard it must be for a teacher, you know, in addition to a librarian, not to mention a school administrator. You know, all of those roles are now complicated much more by the complexity of polarization and, you know, these political, well-funded political movements.
And librarians are afraid.
Mm-hmm.
There's a woman who is not in my book, who was a librarian that I interviewed in Texas, met her in a lobby. She had been basically pushed out of her job. I met with her after she had just had an interview for another job. And,
mm-hmm,
she was just absolutely terrified.
Mm-hmm.
It started because she had her pronouns at the bottom of her email.
Right. Right.
Was called out for that.
It's going to be a crazy year. We're going to want to track this stuff. I'll include information in the show notes. So if folks want to see what Laura's got going on. You've also written other books, you know, so that I think there's plenty to dig into with Laura. Hopefully we'll have her back on again in the future. As folks head back to the rest of their lives, any concluding thoughts, takeaways from today's conversation?
We all have to pay attention. We can't leave it to somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, democracy really is, you know, we need to be involved.
It's not a spectator sport, and it does really begin at a local level. And in a lot of cases, that is at your school board level. So we got to pay attention. It's not something that's going to go away, and it's going to take folks speaking out, not being silent, actually being active to make a difference. Laura Pappano, thank you so much for joining me on today's show.
Thank you, Mike. It's been a pleasure.
And for our listeners, hopefully you enjoyed what you heard. If you did, please subscribe, write us a review, tell your friends, do all the good things. We'll be back again soon. This is Trending in Education.